from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. In 2012, three of the women from the protest band Pussy Riot went on trial in Russia. In her closing statement, one of the accused, Nadia Tolokonnikova, said that the Russian system had become so rigid that it was painful even to breathe the very air of that country. Nadia and one of her counterparts were famously sent to prison for their acts of protest, then released on the eve of the Olympics. Their story is now chronicled by journalist Masha Gessen in her new book, Words Will Break Cement. We'll talk with Gessen about the book and about the human rights struggle in Russia that prompted Gessen, a lesbian mother, to fear for her children's safety and leave her native land. Human rights, Russia, and the Ukraine. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. 2 years ago, three members of the now famous protest band group Pussy Riot went on trial for their actions protesting the rule of Vladimir Putin. Members of that group's story have now been chronicled in Masha Gessen's new book, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. Gessen has long chronicled the struggle for human rights in Russia. Her previous books include The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. And she's also lived that same struggle. Born in Russia, she came to the United States as a teenager in 1981, then moved back to Russia in the 90s, started a family, but as a lesbian mother, came to fear for her children's safety as the government increasingly sought to limit the rights of gays and lesbians in that country. And so she's now moved back to the United States. But she continues to write about events in Russia, continues to report from there as well, events and reporting that, of course, have the entire world watching this very morning. And Masha Gessen joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. I want to ask by asking, in some ways, I think the most basic question that the entire world is wondering about right now, which is, what's Putin going to do?
Well, making predictions is dangerous. But I think let's talk about what he's doing. Right? He's doing what he thinks is right. He is doing something that so far for him has yielded pretty good results. He's restored his popularity, which faltered when the protest movement erupted and had never fully recovered. He has succeeded in mobilizing the population in a way that he hasn't seen since he came to power and started the war in Chechnya. So this has actually been very good for him.
So is this actually a popular point of view within Russia right now, but the possibility of taking over Crimea?
That is a fait accompli. The takeover of Crimea is a done thing. The latest poll by an independent polling organization that I trust shows that only 6% of Russians believe that Russia should not invade Ukraine.
Hmm.
The vast majority believe that ethnic Russians and Russian speakers are in danger in Ukraine. They believe that Ukraine is in a state of anarchy, and that they believe that military intervention is warranted. So he has the full and absolute support of the Russian people.
And it's part of what also has gone on that he has not, in his view at least, not only is he doing what he thinks is right, he hasn't paid a price for past actions, whether that was the invasion of Georgia or other activity. I mean, it's not something that's in any way cost him.
That's exactly right. I mean, he has been violating, mocking, and ignoring international law for years. And yes, the last time in 2008, he bit off a couple of pieces of Georgia, and the world stood by. The world, in fact, as represented by French President Sarkozy, sort of put its stamp of approval on it.
Your book about Putin was called The Man Without a Face. I'm curious about that. But it seems like it also could be titled The Man Who Hasn't Paid a Price or The Man Who Can Do Whatever He Wants to Do. Or I mean, there are any number of ways of describing
it. That's a very good way of putting it. Yes, absolutely. The man who gets away with murder.
And why is that?
Oh, that's a great question. Why is that? I think there has been a combination of factors. One, inside the country. He's been unbelievably lucky. He rode an unprecedented wave of prosperity in Russia. When he came in 1998, just before he came to power, a barrel of Russian oil in the world market was worth $8. So he saw, you know, the country get rich. And actually, when you're living in a country, it's very, very difficult to think that things are bad when things are so good subjectively in your own life. I mean, that's an impossible intellectual exercise. So for the first decade that he was at the helm in Russia, he faced absolutely no opposition internally. I mean, a few isolated intellectuals, but that's about it. In the West, it's been an interesting story. He has benefited from a number of circumstances. One, from not being Yeltsin and having the support of Western leaders because of that, because Yeltsin was so unpredictable and so frightening to a lot of Western leaders. Then he benefited greatly from 9/11 because George Bush sort of accepted him as a partner in fighting the war on terror. And was willing to close his eyes to pretty much everything that Putin did. He also benefited from 9/11 because the eyes of the world turned away from Russia for several years, several key years, when Putin was dismantling the electoral system, taking over the media, basically destroying Russian democracy. And things had to get very, very bad before the world sort of turned to Russia again. That's really only happened in the last couple of years.
And is that not only because we're preoccupied in this country with other threats post 9/11, but also because there's this kind of desire to want to believe in him, that there's this feeling that, well, he's not only not Yeltsin, he's someone, you know, who seems to be representing something that actually is something more positive, that we wanted to maintain a kind of illusion about who he is.
That was very much at play early on, both inside Russia and in the West. He was younger. He wore decent suits. He spoke English with a strong accent, but he made an effort. He spoke pretty good German. So he seemed like a new kind of Russian leader. I mean, those are very superficial signs that he was a new kind of Russian leader. And nobody wanted to look deeper.
And what's then prompted what you write about so wonderfully in your new book about Pussy Riot, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. What began to change then? Take us back to 2010 and the beginnings of concern and protest. What caused Russians at that point, at least some, to push back?
Right. Couple things. One, this was actually an unexpected result of the unprecedented prosperity, because when people live well, after a time, they stop being so concerned with survival, and that's the main political motivation in a very, very poor country, in a country where there's a lot of hardship and a lot of poverty. Sorry, I thought I turned it off.
That's all right. We'll have a little bit of background sound for a moment while you adjust that. Thank you.
Right. So sorry about that. In a country with a lot of poverty, people are primarily concerned with survival, and they vote their survival. In a country where people feel more secure about their future, they start being concerned with corruption, with good governance, and that's very much what was the impetus behind the protests in Russia. The other piece of it was the announcement that Dmitry Medvedev, then the president, and Putin, then the prime minister, made in September 2011, which was that they had decided that Putin would become president again and that they would hold a sham election to sort of put the stamp of approval on that. That was so blatant. That was so out of sync with what people expected of them. People expected to have the basic respect of some formalities before Putin could go back into office. So the humiliation of that, combined with the newfound concern about good governance, is what propelled the protests.
That sham event that you described was also one of the early actions in the group that actually was to become Pussy Riot that you describe in the book, which is a very funny protest action they took. Would you describe that, what they did with replacing photographs in police stations?
Right. This is actually a little bit earlier. This is a different protest group called Vayna, which means war, which in some ways is the predecessor to Pussy Riot. Several members of Pussy Riot participated in Vayna actions or were central to Vayna before they started Pussy Riot. So this was really a terrific action after Dmitry Medvedev was elected, and everybody kind of knew that that he was a placeholder, that Putin put him in his chair to keep the chair warm for 4 years before he came back into power. So Dmitry Medvedev, whom nobody takes seriously, gets elected. And Vayna, they were all very young, so they could pretend to be high school students. And they pretend to be high school students who are going to various police stations in towns around Moscow, replacing the portrait of Putin that hangs over the chief's desk with a portrait of Medvedev, because Medvedev has been inaugurated. And they documented the reaction that these police colonels and captains had, which was of absolute horror. They were paralyzed because on the one hand, they understood that formally this was correct. Obviously, there was a new president and you have to have a portrait of him. But inside, they knew who the real leader of the country was. So it felt like sacrilege. And they had no idea what to do. And so the action was really, the product of that action was the video clip with these cops who are absolutely paralyzed by fear at the sight of having these portraits swapped out.
Some of those early actions by that group that preceded Pussy Riot seemed to me so clever and daring. I mean, another one was where someone dressed as a Russian Orthodox priest but wearing a police cap went in and walked out with a grocery cart full of groceries without paying, making a number of interesting points. And there were a whole series of those. Probably my favorite, this is a little hard to describe on the radio, was where they outlined the outline of a phallus on a drawbridge, which when the drawbridge was to rise, made a rather distinct impression at where it was pointing, which was at the secret police office. Is that right?
Right. It actually that part of the bridge becomes vertical, facing directly the windows of the secret police. So everybody in the secret police building in St. Petersburg was looking at this giant member.
And so what kind of reaction did these early actions begin to take? Did people – I mean, they're remarkably both daring and clever. Did people respond?
It was a thing. It was something that was known to a number of people in Moscow. They were very popular in the Russian art world, which is pretty small and insular. And yes, they were thought to be very inventive and very very interesting. That group broke up sort of because of personal tensions a couple of years before Pussy Riot appeared. And the part of it that remained in Moscow, which was Nadia Talakonnikova and her husband, Petya Verzilov, they were kind of casting about for something to do. And that's part of the reason Pussy Riot was born.
And begin to tell us then that story of what they first did, some of their early actions, which, again, were remarkably bold and clever, both in Red Square, subway stations, and, of course, most famously later than the cathedral. First, describe how daring that was and whether they were aware of what consequences might face them.
Well, that's a great question. It was daring. It was they had started by recording a number of guerrilla performances in various places in Moscow. So in the subway, in pedestrian malls, in various places. And then the protest movement began. And that sort of changed things and raised the stakes, because to push the bounds of protest when protest is suddenly huge is a much more difficult task, a much more interesting task. That's how they ended up doing an action in Red Square in January 2012, and a month after that, doing an action in the Cathedral of Christ the Savior. And at that point, this is February 21st, 2012, 2 weeks before the presidential election in which Putin will claim that he now is the legitimate president of Russia for the third time. And Putin is faced with a mass protest movement, which infuriates him and scares him at the same time. So as Russian leaders always do, he reaches for the Russian Orthodox Church to help him. So the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church was campaigning for Putin, was comparing him to God. Parish priests were campaigning for Putin and telling their parishioners not to attend protests because that's not what Russian Orthodox believers do. And Pussy Riot goes into the cathedral to protest that symbiosis of church and state and to point out sort of the corruption that is endemic to this particular physical space, and then there's a whole sort of backstory to that, and the corruption that's inherent in the relationship of the president and the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church. And it's hard to believe now, but 2 years ago, people weren't actually going to jail in Russia for peaceful protest. It began with Pussy Riot. So while they thought they knew this was high stakes, they knew this was daring, they didn't think they were risking jail time. I mean, it was a brilliant prank played by a couple of college students.
It's, you know, we I said this to you before our program began, that part of what was so striking to me, and I confess my own lack of realization of this, is how young they are, still are. I mean, they're kids, really, sort of taking on, literally taking on the state and church at the same time.
Absolutely. Well, Maria and Nadia, the two members of Pussy Riot who ended up spending 2 years in prison, they're now seasoned political prisoners. They're world famous, and they're 24 and 25 years old, respectively.
And give us a snapshot of each of them, because in part just because of the name Pussy Riot, because of the sort of the pranks and the lyrics that they use, I had a certain image of them that's very different when you read about them. I mean, they seem actually very sweet and tactful and lovely. Is that right?
Well, they're all different people. The book documents the backstories of three women, the three who were unmasked. Because one thing I should mention is that Pussy Riot is, on principle, an anonymous group. It's an open membership art collective that anybody can join. You can put on a balaclava and call yourself Pussy Riot, but you cannot call yourself Pussy Riot when you take off the balaclava. That's the rules. So only three women have spoken with their real names about their participation in Pussy Riot, because they were the ones who were unmasked and put on trial. So I looked at their stories and how they came to their activism. Their stories are all very different. And Nadia and Maria are the ones who ended up serving the full sentences and who now sort of represent Pussy Riot in our imagination. Nadia is this self-taught philosopher, very much an autodidact, brilliant.
Very much what?
An autodidact, brilliant, very studious, very sort of serious about in her thinking. And to her, one of the greatest dilemmas she faced when she was in prison was that she wanted to have the existential experience of an ordinary prisoner. She didn't want to be the superstar prisoner. She didn't want to get the special treatment. She thought, once she landed in prison, she should use that experience to sort of get some philosophical footing in the prison experience. Maria is cut of completely different cloth. She her classmates told me that they always thought she would change the world. And they said, you know, I would feel silly saying this if she weren't in prison, but I guess it's true. She is very much an activist. She started out in the environmental movement. Everything she says is very heartfelt and very intimate. And the book actually contains several of her letters from prison written to family and friends, which are much more interesting, and intimate and introspective than anything she would have written to me. They're also brilliantly written.
I want to get to some of those letters in a bit. But before we get to the period of their incarceration and what that was like, set the stage for us for the trial itself, what they were actually charged with. The charge itself is kind of strange. I mean, to a Westerner, the charge is strange.
Oh, it's strange.
Yeah. Okay. Describe what they were charged with and set the scene for the trial itself, which was extraordinary in its own way.
The charge was felony hooliganism. Felony hooliganism is defined as the crude disturbance of social order that is motivated by hatred for a particular social group. So they were basically convicted of a hate crime. And the prosecution claimed that they were motivated by their hatred of Russian Orthodox believers. This was very painful for them, because they don't have a hateful bone in their bodies.
And describe, at least, I believe, is it Maria who describes herself as a Russian Orthodox?
Yes. And she like a lot of Russians, she hasn't grown up inside the church, but she has grown up with a strong affinity for the church. And that's a major part of her identity. And to sit there in a plastic box, which is where they were held in the courtroom because they're dangerous criminals, to sit there in a plastic box for 9 days, listening to people testify to her hatred for Russian Orthodox believers, was a mind-boggling and very painful experience for her.
And describe the song that they actually sang again in the church and the point that it was actually trying to make. Because it was interesting, the focus of the charges was really on this question of whether or not they were doing something that was threatening of the church, although their point, of course, was much more focused toward the state.
Right. They were not allowed to quote their lyrics in court, because everything was to be done to avoid the appearance of a political trial. It was essentially a blasphemy trial. But they kept trying to say, but listen to the lyrics, listen to what we actually said. What they actually were saying was, Mother of God, chase Putin out. And then it was a litany, a literal litany of sort of crimes committed by the Russian state against various civil liberties.
It's so, you know, it's so interesting that it was this trial of religious blasphemy. What struck me when I was reading it was that it seemed a bit like the Salem witch trials, you know, in this country in the 17th century, because they were accused of things like devilish jerkings. I mean, it was very, very strange. And I'm just fascinated by how that, whatever reporting there was of that trial, how people reacted to that and whether or not it seemed like a sham or whether or not people really did think that, oh, well, they really are being blasphemous.
Right. Well, it depends on where people got their information. But yeah, they were accused of devilish jerkings. They were accused of being possessed. And the judge actually very seriously sort of stopped the testimony of one witness and said, the witness does not have a medical degree, so cannot render a diagnosis of possession. I mean, that... To think that that was happening in the largest city in Europe in 2012 is mind-boggling. So most Russians get their information from state-controlled television. And if they got their information from that, then they have a very strong impression of Pussy Riot as a bunch of young women who went into a church and defecated. While the trial was going on, there were three different films about Pussy Riot that were released on Russian state channels that beam out to 98% of the households in the country. So there's a very small minority of people who got their information about the trial from independent media.
And we have to take a break in just a moment, but how were you trying to get your writing out? Because you were covering the trial at that point. How are you trying to get a different version of what was going on out to your fellow Russians?
Actually, I wasn't covering the trial at the time.
Oh, sorry.
I was observing the trial. I was working on I was editor of a popular science magazine at the time, which is a whole other story. But I was fired from that job a couple of weeks later for refusing to send a reporter with Putin. At the time, I wasn't covering the trial. The journalists who were covering the trial, it was pretty difficult. And I attended the trial a couple of times. The only people who were allowed in the courtroom were the first few journalists who arrived. Only journalists were allowed even near the courthouse. The general public was kept at a fair distance from the courthouse by the police. And this was legally a public trial. The journalists were not allowed to film the prosecution or the judge, only the actual defendants, because they're such dangerous criminals that the prosecution and the judge and the witnesses for the prosecution feared retribution. It was this constant sort of escalation of fear and this constant portrayal of them as extremely dangerous.
And that still is going on now, right? I mean, in terms of we've just read about certain political opponents being – one is under house arrest right now, Alexei Navalny. I mean, there's no more – if anything, have things gotten – tougher in terms of how protest and opposition is viewed?
Well, that was part of my motivation for writing the book, was because Pussy Riot, aside from being a fascinating story, is also very indicative of what's going on in Russia. They were the beginning of the crackdown that has been going on for the last 2 years now, and that has intensified again with the war in Ukraine.
We will continue with Masha Gessen in just a moment, talk more about what happened with the Pussy Riot trial, their incarceration, their letters from jail, and the state right now of opposition within Russia, and the great question that everyone is wondering about these days, what is Vladimir Putin going to do next? We'll talk about all of that with Masha Gessen when we return. 866-733-6786 is our number if you have a question for her. 866-733-6786. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, Masha Gessen. Her book is called Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. The title, of course, comes from a line from Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the Nobel laureate, Words Will Break Cement. Do you still believe that?
There's an obvious irony to using that as the title of the book, because the words come from Alexander Solzhenitsyn. They're quoted by Nadia in her closing statement. And she says it hopefully. She says, I believe that in the end, words will break cement. And it breaks my heart that she's repeating something that Solzhenitsyn said 50 years earlier. And things are pretty much the same.
their writings from jail are so poignant and eloquent, and it made me think about a bit about Martin Luther King's letters from Birmingham jail. Maria writes at one point while she's – I guess this is her closing statement before before she was sentenced, where she writes, "No one can take away my inner freedom. It lives in my words and it will survive thanks to the public nature of my statement, which will be heard and read by thousands. This freedom is multiplying thanks to every caring person who hears us in this country." But can those words be heard? Are they heard now?
This is true. What she said is true. Their trial, which became, in a way, a part of their performance. And if you think of the arc of that performance, the sort of these hooligans going into the Cathedral of Christ the Savior, then the witch trial, and then the final coda being these three very different but very eloquent closing statements that sort of explain what you have just witnessed. And what you have just witnessed is the Russia's slide into the Middle Ages. It's an incredible piece of art. And that is certainly a piece of art that a lot of people in the world saw and understood. I mean, I think that the impact of the entire Pussy Riot, of that entire Pussy Riot performance that began in February and ended in August, is comparable to the impact of Solzhenitsyn's Archipelago Gulago. It was with the publication of that book that the West sort of got the full horror of what was happening in the Soviet Union. It took that. Stalin's crimes and everything that the United States knew about what was going on in the Soviet Union after Stalin. None of that had the kind of impact that that book by Solzhenitsyn had. And I think that's exactly what Pussy Riot did. And I think that's a fair comparison. So in that sense, yes, absolutely, they were heard and they had a huge impact. And they're still heard. I mean, they have the ear of the world media. They have the ear of the two or three people who are still trying to do independent media in Russia, which took a great hit yesterday. And they have a voice of moral authority, and they're using it.
Describe why it took a great hit yesterday.
Oh, just in the last couple of days, I mean, the biggest news resource in Russia was taken over by the Kremlin. The biggest news online news site that was independently owned, the owner summarily fired the editor-in-chief and replaced her with a Kremlin hand. It's a very blatant move. And this was a website that had about 8 million people a month going to it. And then yesterday they started shutting off access to particular websites, opposition websites and individual blogs. So they're starting a sniper attack.
If the actions of Pussy Riot and their writings are analogous to Alexander Solzhenitsyn, is today's time in Putin analogous to the worst of times in the old Soviet Union?
You know, I try to stay away from those comparisons because the problem with them is you start immediately talking about distinctions and how it's different. And there are definitely differences. Let's just look at it on the face of it. I mean, this is a man who has destroyed the Russian electoral system, destroyed the independent media, who's throwing his opponents in jail. Some of his opponents are being killed. He is invading neighboring countries with impunity, and he shows no sign of stopping. That's pretty awful on its own terms without comparing it to anybody else.
Masha Gessen again, our guest. You can join our conversation at 866-733-6786. Tell us your story, because you represent another aspect of the human rights struggle within Russia as a lesbian mom. What did you come to fear about your family, your children, which in turn, in the end, prompted you, your own decision to leave again, to leave Russia a second time?
I'm almost grateful to Putin for leaving me no choice. Because, of course, as the crackdown that began with the arrest of Pussy Riot proceeded, a lot of us in Russia were sort of weighing things and trying to figure out whether it was time to leave or whether we could keep staying and keep trying to do our work as journalists. And then the anti-gay campaign began, and it's the legislation that people in this country have heard about is a small part of it. Mostly it's just a campaign of hatred and incitement to violence. And in May of last year, May, June of last year, the parliament made it clear that they were going to pass legislation that would create a mechanism for removing children from same-sex families. My partner and I have three kids. It was clear that they were going to go after a family first. We're named in many of these conversations by name. We're the most publicly out same-sex family in Russia.
You and your partner were.
Yeah, we were. That was a non-discussion discussion. I mean,
so the law that went forward wasn't just to say gay people can't adopt. It would also have annulled or taken away children from existing family relationships?
There are a couple of different things. One was a ban on same-sex adoptions and adoptions by single people from countries where same-sex marriage is legal that went into effect in June. It's not clear that it couldn't be applied to existing adoptions, and our oldest son is adopted. And because one of the proponents of that law actually named our family specifically, we were advised by the adoption lawyer to get our son, who's been in the family since the year 2000, to get him out of the country. So in Russia, there is such a legal procedure called an annulment of adoption.
The advice, as I recall, I remember reading either in an interview you did or a piece that you wrote that you got about what you should do was pretty stunning in that the advice you received involved two words. One was run and the other was airport. Can you describe that advice you received?
Yes. I wrote a letter to a friendly adoption lawyer asking him whether I was overreacting to this interview that this politician had given. And he wrote, "The answer to your question is at the airport," which means get the hell out of the country. And he also wrote, "Until you can get out of the country, teach your son to run. If he is approached in the street by strangers, he should never engage. He should run in the opposite direction." It's frightening. It's also absurd. You can't tell a 15-year-old to run away from strangers. And that was one of the difficult things in navigating this in the months that we're getting ready to leave. How do you tell teenagers that they're no longer safe in the streets of a city in which they grew up, where they feel completely comfortable, where they take the subway, where they feel like they own the city and they can go visit their friends and do all the things that teenagers do that make up their lives?
So
all of a sudden, they were robbed of this.
What did you say to your son?
I told both of the older kids exactly what was going on and exactly how scared I was and how they needed to report to us on their every move. And all the fights that we had with my son before he finally left the country at the end of June of last year concerned his turning off his cell phone because he was hanging out with friends. It's ridiculous when you have to tell your son, look, if you had been taken into the police station, and I wouldn't have learned about it for hours because your phone was turned off. That is unacceptable. the kids, I think my son is still very, very angry at Russia, and which is probably an easier thing for an emigre kid to have than what my daughter feels, which is a lot of hurt.
Again, our guest, Masha Gessen, her book, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. We'd like to hear from you as well. You can join us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts or questions on our website or on our Facebook page. Let's take a couple of calls. Peter joins us first in Berkeley. Peter, go ahead.
Thank you. And I appreciate the courage of your guest. I just wanted to say that right up at the top. Vladimir Putin made a big point to the American people when he wrote us directly in the New York Times last September 11th that it was important to follow international law. And he also made a big point about the UN veto and how that had provided a lot of stability since the Second World War. And those points are valid. So I'm thinking that we should try to argue in a very respectful way with President Putin, acknowledge his real politic power in Russia, acknowledge his being part of the power club of the world right now because the UN veto concentrates that power to say no to everybody else in five individual leaders in the world when it comes down to it, because each of those five leaders can appoint that single representative to cast that one vote to block everything. So acknowledge all that and say, say, Mr. Putin, with great respect, you argued for international law, and in the close of your piece, you made a big point about equality. And we'd like you to provide leadership for the whole world to use Article 109 of the United Nations Charter, call a global constitutional charter review or convention, we could say, a modern-day convention. And because you have security, you can say no to the whole world. You're one of five nations and five people who can. Therefore, you have security. Give us leadership.
Peter, let me hold you there. Thank you for raising the point. And let's,
well, thank you. I'd love a reaction.
Yeah, no, let's hear what Masha Gessa thinks Putin's reaction to that very tactful, diplomatic argument might be.
I think he would laugh. That's not the conversation he's having with the world. That's not the conversation he was having when he wrote that op-ed piece in the New York Times on Syria. The conversation he was having then was, look, I've caught you in a trap you set for yourself with your own words. That's all. And now I own the Syria debate. It was a great victory for him, but it was really for the pleasure of owning that part of the world's politics. It was not to make a principal point.
And you also have argued that what he believes is that he is doing what every government leader would really like to do, and his government is doing what every government would really like to do. They'd all like to behave this way. He just has the courage of his convictions.
That's absolutely right. He is convinced that that international law is an inconvenience that gets in the way, and that most world leaders would like to break international law at every turn. And only the United States and Russia have the courage to do that sometimes. But he is braver than the United States because he does it more.
Do you think there is anything that would get his attention, that would change, you know, we were saying earlier, the title of your book about Putin could have been The Man Who, you know, Does Whatever He Wants, or The Man Who Never Pays a Price. Is there anything that would make him stop, that would make him feel like, oh, I guess I will pay a price if I do this or that?
Yes, but I don't think that strategically it would work. So that creates a pretty impossible situation for the rest of the world. Basically, is any kind of symbolic action would open up the West to ridicule. So, you know, either cajoling him the way that the caller suggested, or kicking him out of international organizations. At this point, that only confirms his view that the West is weak and can't do anything about what he is doing. Now, serious economic sanctions, not the kind that Europe is discussing right now, but real economic sanctions that would close off Russia's access to U.S. banks, that would really curtail Russia's activities on the Western European markets. Those sanctions would impact Russia a great deal and fast. The problem with and Putin would certainly notice that. The problem with that is that that would only increase the mobilization in Russia. That would only increase the hostility. That would only make the war effort greater. And then, of course, a military response, even if it were on the table, would do the same thing, except faster and stronger. So the question is, what do you do when there is no strategically sound solution? And I think you acknowledge that there's no strategic solution and you do the right thing. And the right thing is not to talk to a dictator who gets away with everything. The right thing is to take a moral stand and to kick Russia out of every international institution and to impose serious economic sanctions that will hurt the Russian elite.
Would you have liked to have seen the United States do what Jimmy Carter did back in 1980, not participate in the Olympics? I know that's such a small gesture in some ways, but is that the kind of thing that has to happen?
That's a symbolic action. I think that's a very good response to, say, the anti-gay legislation. That's not a good response to war, to occupying a neighboring country. So I don't think that was particularly effective in 1980, and I don't think it would have been particularly effective now. I actually think that President Obama's actions with regards to the Olympics were absolutely brilliant. The athletes went, but the politicians didn't. And I wish that other Western countries had done the same thing.
What about encouraging, or is this just not possible at this point, protest, democratic movements within Russia itself? There's a passage in the book where you comment that about sort of this sort of passivity, I guess, lack of pushback in Russia right now, and that the country, quote, seemed endlessly willing to accept whatever it was handed, whether that's enormous income discrepancy, rampant corruption, or the lies that underlie it all. Endlessly willing to accept whatever is handed. Is that the state of Russia now?
I think it is the state of most of Russia. I think that we're not going to see changes in that again in the context of a war, because that's what mobilizes a population and renders everything else trivial. So in terms of supporting protest from the West, we have to understand how great the stakes of protest are at this point. People are going to jail for peaceful protest. Not everybody. But every time there's a protest, somebody gets arrested, or many people get arrested, and some of them then face felony charges. It's highly selective, and that's exactly the way that effective terror works, is by communicating to the population that enforcement will be selective, and you're always at risk, and you can never predict when you're more or less at risk. There are also backbreaking fines for breaking new, very, very restrictive public assembly laws. So encouraging people to participate in protest is a double-edged sword. I'm very much in favor of protest, but you have to understand how dangerous it is. What I think the West can and should do is what happened with Pussy Riot and what has happened to a much lesser extent and hasn't been effective with other political prisoners, which is shine a light on them. Hmm. Know them by name. It's not just Pussy Riot. They're about... but there are not so many people in Russian jails that we can't know them all by name. There are about 30 or 40 political prisoners in Russia right now who really need to be known in the West, to be identified and to be watched. That's the only thing that will keep them alive.
Some comments coming in from our listeners. Rick writes, I'm so enamored by this amazing group, Pussy Riot. They are brave, indomitable. I believe they will conquer the bear. Mm-hmm. I wonder if they knew what penalties they would face when they began. Too bad that America does not have such an intelligent, sly, and brave group. We need that kind of activism in this country as well. Steve writes, it seems from Masha's comments that the Russian people, because of the state control of Russian media, do not realize the extent to which they lack information about their own country and the world. I'm surprised that they're willing to accept such restrictions. So does Masha think that the availability of the internet will eventually bring more openness to their media? Well, I suppose part of what you're saying was so significant about what happened with that one news website yesterday.
I would say yesterday was the day that Putin killed the internet. They started shutting off access to individual websites, and they will continue doing so. And so access to information on the internet is now extremely unreliable, and people expect social networks to be shut down in the near future.
To our calls. Let's go next to Carl in San Jose. Carl, go ahead, please.
I've been very frustrated for 14 years. About how Putin gets away with this stuff, and I'm so grateful that Marcia can get this word out. I hope that she can get on radio stations 24 hours a day for the next month. Let me just say that, Marcia, this problem of corruption and criminality in Russia, I finally, after many trips to the Soviet Union, I realized that it's probably because of communism. And during communism, it was illegal to be a businessman. So every businessman became a criminal, and they just stayed that way. And I wondered if the only rationale that I can see for Russians supporting Putin and knowing who he is and what he's been doing is that he's a criminal like a godfather who can control all the other criminals. Do you agree with that?
I think that's a really good point. I think that there are many ways in which he communicates the message that he is the only one who can keep the country safe and in line, that there are always greater dangers lurking around the corner, that the country is surrounded by enemies. So he is the only one who can protect Russia against the scary Ukraine or against the greedy businessmen who are taking your money, but he's still keeping them at bay. And if only he went away, they would take over. He plays, very effectively on everybody's fears.
And give us more insight, if you would, Masha, to that sense of fear. I mean, what made you fearful to people? What is it about gays and lesbians that strikes people as being fearful in Russia? What is it about that seems so central to Russia's history, this sort of sense of fear of the outside and the appeal of a Putin-like leader?
Well, that's a great question. I don't have a good explanation for why Russia has had such a siege mentality historically, because historically it has not been a country under siege. But that's traditional Russian politics dating back centuries. Putin is very effective at using that. He taps right into that sort of fear that has been passed on through generations. Now, one of the instruments of that fear is focusing on a minority and making it the root of all evil. That has happened with Jews in Russia and in other countries. And now in Russia, it has happened with the gays. The gays are a great minority for that purpose because, of course, nobody thinks that they've met a gay or lesbian person in Russia. So it's very easy to portray LGBT people as both extremely dangerous and less than human. And that's what you need in order to create this kind of imaginary monster. And I just want to add that you might think that this anti-gay campaign has dissipated because of Ukraine. But actually, there's something much greater at the root of all this. Putin now believes that he has the civilizational mission to make Russia the traditional values capital of the world. And part of the war that he's fighting in Ukraine is to shore up the traditional values civilization against the encroaching West.
Tell the story, if you would, that you told on Fresh Air with Terry Gross about the writer that you had to – or that you wanted to fire for something that he wrote – because it's so astonishing that anyone would even think that.
Right. So this is actually a piece I wrote for the New York Times when a very prominent Russian actor and writer and sort of personality made a comment in December of last year that gays and lesbians should be put into gas ovens alive. And I knew this guy. I had worked with him. He had been a columnist at a magazine that I edited. And he had written about 3 years before he made that comment. He wrote a column that said, that was titled, "Yes, I'm a Racist." And it said that if one of his daughters brought home an African man, then he would drive both of them out into the woods and shoot them. So I wanted to fire him over that column, and the publisher wouldn't let me because it would look bad if we fired somebody over his opinions. And that's been sort of an ongoing theme in Russia. I mean, it's an ongoing theme for any editor. Like, when has someone gone too far? What are the limits of what can be said in a particular society? The problem with Russia is that there's incredible misuse of the concept of freedom of speech and freedom of opinion. And for most of the country, that means there is no limit to the hateful comments that you can make. And it means that I didn't have the right to fire him over his opinion. So it took me several months to get rid of him. And I finally told him that we needed to get some fresh blood into the magazine and that sort of thing. And I felt horrible about it when I saw that ovens comment because I thought, well, I was a part of making that.
Hmm. And do you have any sense, I guess, other than inculcating more people like the women of Pussy Riot, that will push back against that, that will somehow bring about a transformation within Russia so that that is not acceptable?
I'm feeling very, very hopeless right now. And one of the things that I've been thinking for the last few months is there's something that is incredibly damaging to the national psyche that has been done to Russia so many times that I think it was a little foolhardy of us of us, Russians and Americans, to expect Russia to sort of magically recover in the 1990s. Here was an entire population that had been subjected to extreme abuse for decades. And when that happens to an individual, we know that the individual needs therapy and intervention and all sorts of treatment and coddling in order to be able to function again. When that happens to a whole country, why do we expect it to sort of get up and go? And is it at all surprising that it has gone back to its abuser like a woman would do?
Hmm. Let's take one more call. Zavin in Palo Alto.
is hi. First of all, I'd like to say that I really appreciate Marsha's comments. It's very, those are standing out for their objectivity, their deepness, and objective analysis of events in Russia. I would like to mention that in a way, the way that United States acted in case with Iraq and Afghanistan, which created this impression that you can act or mismanage the facts and present your case and do something really big that would influence many, many people in the world.
So, Ben, I'm so sorry. I'm going to have to hold you there just because we're almost out of time, and I want to let Marsha give a brief response. Thanks for raising the question.
No, you're absolutely right. I think that that has affirmed Putin's view that, yes, any government in the world would act exactly the way he's acting if it had the courage of his convictions. And he believes that George W. Bush had the courage of his convictions. And right for the last 6 years, he has been dealing with a much weaker American leader who doesn't have the courage of his convictions. And only Putin knows how to fix the world.
You said a moment ago that you weren't feeling very hopeful. And yet, you're a writer, you're a reporter, you're a journalist. What do you want to keep writing? What are the words that you think you can summon that might, if not break cement, at least put a few dents in it?
Well, my last two books haven't been translated into Russian.
So really
at this point, I have to admit that I'm not speaking to Russia. I'm speaking to other countries in the world. I'm fortunate to have my books translated into many, many other languages besides English. I mean, they're written in English, but they're translated into many languages. And I'm doing what Pussy Riot has done, which is try to change the world's view of Russia and inform it.
Marsha Gettin, the book again, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. Thank you for your words and for the courage of your convictions. Thanks for being on our program.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Dan Zoll, our senior editor. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.